Great to have you along on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Hi, Larry Mueller here talking taxes today. Tax season, you know, kind of begins next week on January 23rd. Tax returns are due April 18th this year, so now's a good time to get organized for filing taxes and figuring out what extra steps you need to take to make tax season a little cheaper, a little less stressful. My guest today, Mary Mellum of Ashwaubenon Tax Professionals, back once again. She and her husband, David, have been in the tax business about 30 years, serving individuals, consulting other tax professionals, and teaching tax seminars around the country. She's happy to answer your questions. What would you like to know about ending 2016 in the best possible way in terms of your taxes? I hope you'll join us at 1-800-642-1234. Email at talk@wpr.org or post on our Facebook page at The Larry Mueller Show. And Mary Mellum, welcome back. Great to have you with us.
Thank you, Larry. It's nice to be here.
Well, let's talk about any strategies that people might be able to employ to lower their 2016 tax burden, even at in 2017.
Well, there's two things that I can think of most often that will help an after-the-fact end of the year. And those two would be HSA contributions if they are part of a health savings account or have the high deductible health insurance, and the other is contributing to an IRA. Now, both of those are for people who are basically under the age of 65. So for those over the age of 65, those two things generally are not helpful. Although IRAs, if you're still working after between 65 and 70, it may still be an option for you.
Okay. So something, if you're under 65, probably a little bit more of an opportunity than if you're over. How do you get organized for tax time? You know, I keep all mine.
That's a wonderful question, Larry. I've had people tell me that every time a letter comes with important tax information, they stick it in a file. I think that's great, but sometimes it may not be disclosed that way. So I suggest that they either have a worksheet or a guide, or if not that, take a look at last year's tax return and start from the top down and take a look at what did I have last year, because it's more than likely that they'll have those things this year. And start putting together those things as early as possible.
Yeah, I think that's a good idea. I do keep most of my things in a folder, and every time I donate or something, that information goes into that folder. And then I usually spend, when I'm figuring out my taxes or before I do it, I sort of organize the information. So all the donations kind of go in one pile and other things go in another pile, and makes it a little easier.
In our office, we have a tax worksheet that we send out to our clients, and it basically goes through a number of items, and it says, if you have this, you'll need this. And I think that having something like that is a good idea, especially to trigger new things that might be happening to people.
Yeah, a very, very good point. How do people know which are the correct tax forms to file? It sounds like you helped them out a little bit in that way.
Well, in terms of the correct tax forms, basically we have a 1040. There is a 1040A, and there's a 1040NR. Those are the kind of three basic individual tax returns. A 1040, we in our office use a 1040. The reason is that anybody can use a 1040. It covers all of the kinds of income that a U.S. citizen or resident alien would need. The 1040A is kind of a watered-down version of it. It's one that doesn't include itemized deductions, and there are certain things that you can't do with a 1040A. many people who have relatively simple tax returns can use a 1040A, but I encourage people who are doing their return themselves to look at a 1040 because it might trigger something different.
Yeah.
The last form I mentioned is an unusual one. It's a 1040NR, and that is for someone who is here that has not been here long enough to be treated like a U.S. citizen, and they have special rules, and that's the 1040NR.
Okay. Well, Vicki in Thiensville has a question for you, so let's go to Vicki. Hi, Vicki. Thanks for calling.
My question is on calculating the cost basis for stock that was purchased over time, monthly, for example, from back in the 80s, and it may have gone on for 15, 20 years purchasing the stock. And if you don't have the exact records of every purchase, how do you best calculate the cost basis?
Well, that's a tough one because records are important. If you know it's been purchased every month and you know how much you've purchased or how much you invested, you know, like a monthly thing, you may be able to go back to a historical stock record, and you can do that online. There are some historical sites. And to look at what the stock price was on the approximate date that you would have purchased that. That would give you an idea of how many shares you got with the money that you purchased. If not, it's a difficult thing. And the best way, I mean, you come up with the best accounting that you can of it, keeping in mind that if you can't prove basis, the IRS has the right to make that number zero. So if you are purchasing stock, it is very important to keep those records, to go through a broker who keeps those records or some vision of that way.
So if you went through a broker, the broker should have that information.
No, this would have been through an employer.
Ah.
And I assume the employer is not able to get you that information?
Well, I guess listening to what you're saying, that would be the first thing to try.
That would be. There are some large companies who do employee stock purchase plans, and I know that they keep records.
Oh, good. That's what this would be. So that could help.
All right. Good luck.
Thank you.
Thanks a lot for calling. Appreciate your call. You can join in, too. Number to call, 1-800-642-1234. Give a call with your tax question. Let's go to Jim and Racine next. Jim, hi. Thank you for calling.
Hi, and good morning. I generally do my own taxes, and it's a short 1040 form. But this year, I have a problem because I don't know anything about capital gains in Wisconsin or Michigan. I'm a resident of Wisconsin, and I sold a hunting camp in the UP of Michigan. Now, what do I need to get that done as far as capital gains is concerned?
For Wisconsin purposes, well, for federal purposes, your capital gain is reported on a form 8949. You need to know when you purchased it, when you sold it, how much you sold it for, and how much you paid for it, adjusted for anything that happened between the time that you bought it and you sold it, like improvements or casualty losses that you might have or something that affected the property. For state purposes, if you are a resident of Wisconsin, it doesn't matter where that property is located, it's a taxable event to Wisconsin. At the same time, depending on the size of the sale and the filing requirements for Michigan, you may also have to file a Michigan return and report that income on the Michigan return. Wisconsin, to avoid double taxation, Wisconsin also has a credit for taxes paid to the other state. What you have to be careful of in this case is that Wisconsin has a reduced rate for capital gains, and I'm not sure what the rate is for the state of Michigan, but if Wisconsin's rate is lower, you're only going to get the benefit that you are getting on the Wisconsin return for what you paid to Michigan.
Oh, okay. Now, where do I get this 8949 form?
If you go to the IRS website, you would see, you could look for forms and get the 8949. It feeds into the Schedule D. A couple of years ago, we had some changes in the format, and the Schedule D had always been the form where you calculated your sales of property and stocks and bonds. But this is a kind of a feeder into that form.
Yeah. And if you're driving by your local library, I'm willing to bet that the library would have copies of that as well.
Well, thank you both.
Yeah, thanks a lot for calling. Appreciate your call. And Rich in Huntley, Illinois, your turn. Hi, Rich.
Hi. Hey, I haven't worked for a year, and I took out some money from an IRA to pay the bills, which was less than, and I don't know what the line is for filing taxes or not filing taxes. As far as income goes, but I know I have to pay a penalty or for the IRA money I took out. So how does that work when taxes come around?
I assume you're under the age of 59 and a half.
Yeah, I'm 64.
You're 64. Okay.
If you're 64 and you took money out of an IRA, you shouldn't have a penalty to worry about. And if you're under the filing requirement, you may not need to file. Did you have withholding taken out of your IRA distribution?
No, I didn't.
Okay. Are you single or another filing status?
No, I'm single.
Okay. For 2016, for a single person, the filing requirement, the 10% tax bracket goes, or the filing requirement would be 9276. That's where your 10% bracket would start.
$9,276.
Right, that's where you'd be in your tax bracket. You have a standard deduction this year of $6,300 actually, and $4,050. So the actual filing requirement would be $10,350.
Okay, So I was above that, so I have to file.
If the distribution that you have is above that, then you certainly have to file a tax return. And it may not be a large amount of tax, and certainly there's no penalty with the age that you told us.
Well, I didn't get the penalty, but you solved the problem, so thank you.
All right. Thanks very much for calling, Rich. Appreciate your call. Talking today with Mary Mellum, tax professional from Green Bay, Wisconsin, who is with her husband David operating Ashwaubenon Tax Professionals. They are enrolled agents. Great to have her with us again on the Ideas Network. Jill Nadeau, our on-air producer. Taking a look at your taxes today with Mary Mellum of Ashwaubenon Tax Professionals of Green Bay. Larry Mueller here. Great to have you along today on the Ideas Network. Lines are all filled. The number is 800-642-1234. Email at talk@wpr.org or post on our Facebook page at The Larry Mueller Show. Let's go next to Karen in Janesville. Karen, hi. Thank you for calling.
Hi, Larry. Thank you so much. My question is about being... I earned an incentive trip through a direct sales company, and now I've noticed that I have to pay taxes on that much, that amount, and I was wondering why and how I have to do it. It's coming on whatever form that is that I get for my earnings.
Federal law says that anything you receive is basically taxable. This incentive is part of your earned income, and that's why it's taxable. You got it because of an earnings situation. And even if you had won it in a contest, it would still be taxable income. It's probably going to come through either on your W-2 or on a 1099 miscellaneous, depending on who's the one that's offering the incentive.
And right, it's a 1099.
The 1099 miscellaneous. Do you have? Are you an employee, or do you have your own business?
Basically, I'm doing direct sales, so I'm an independent consultant.
Okay. If you're an independent person, you probably file a Schedule C, and you would include this 1099 miscellaneous with that income.
Okay.
All right.
All right, thanks. I just hadn't thought about that one. When I got it in, I noticed.
I know some folks who had won a trip, and then when they found out they were going to have to pay taxes on it, they refused the trip. They didn't want to pay they didn't want to go on the trip if they had to pay the tax on it. So that's sometimes how it works.
The only way that things are not taxable is if they happen to be a gift, and it's very hard to have a gift when you have an employment relationship or a contest.
Yeah. On to Marcy next in, Marcy at Appleton. Hi, thanks for calling.
Hi. I'm calling because we've started 70 and a half.
Minimum required distributions.
Minimum.
Right, acquired, right. And we've also purchased a house in California, and we're Wisconsin residents. And we're not sure whether we can deduct the interest on that house in California and any expenses for the sale of the house, the purchase of the house.
First of all, I'm assuming it's your second home and you're not changing your residence.
That's correct.
Okay. For federal purposes, a second home, the interest, the property taxes, all of that is allowed on your Schedule A for your federal return. If you remain a Wisconsin resident, Wisconsin likes you to stay here, and they do not give an itemized deduction credit for property owned outside of the United or outside of the state of Wisconsin. So there'd have to be an adjustment, or just to know that there is no benefit on the Wisconsin as an itemized deduction credit for the mortgage interest that you might be paying on the California home.
Okay.
As far as closing costs and things like that, generally those things go into the cost basis of that California property. And by cost basis, I mean your purchase price that you would use later or your cost of your building that you would use later against the sales price if you should sell it in the future.
Okay. But I can then deduct the interest and...
On your federal return, you can deduct property taxes paid and mortgage interest paid with no problem.
Okay. Wow.
An adjustment.
All right. Oh, that's great.
All right.
Okay, thank you so much.
Yep, thanks so much for calling. Appreciate your call. And... let's turn to Gary in Appleton next. Gary, hi. Thank you for calling.
Good morning.
Morning.
I have a question and about required minimum distributions. I want to make sure I'm doing this right. It'll be happening in the future. My understanding is IRAs, you can consolidate them all when you're calculating like your RMD, but on 401Ks, if you have multiples, you got to calculate them separately and pay out the proper amount out of each RMD. And then I assume that they'll give you the 1099s and you just file those on the proper lines in the 1040. And I'm just trying to make sure that everything's done right so that, you know,
okay,
the IRS has the information they need to know that you did it right.
When in the future are you talking about meeting this requirement? When in the future are you talking? Is this a 2018 issue, a 2017? When will you reach
2 years? 2 years from now.
Okay, so 2 years from now would be 2019. What you said is exactly correct. As far as IRAs are concerned, they can be put into a bundle, so to speak. And your minimum required distribution is the balance in each account at the end of the prior year, so that would be 2018 if you turn 70 and a half in 2019, divided by the factor that goes along with a certain chart. The first number is 27.4 generally for most people. Companies are either required, the people, the custodian that holds your IRA is either required to tell you what you have to take out of that account or offer to tell you that. But you have, as far as IRAs are concerned, you have the right to take the total amount out of one IRA or multiple, however you want to split it, just so you get that total amount out in that year. And exactly what you said about 401ks or other company pension plans, they stand on their own, and each one has to have its amount taken out of each specific plan.
Okay. How does the IRS, how do they check to make sure you've done everything right?
It's just like auditing, that they can look at your age and expect to see that, because they get, for instance, for IRAs, they get 5498 forms every year that tell how much is the balance in your account. So if they are to match that information, they could send you a letter saying, oops, it looks like you didn't take the money out. Most times, it's an audit situation that would cause that.
Okay.
All right. Thanks very much.
Thank
you. Yeah, thanks, Gary, for calling. Appreciate your call. And on to Mary in Racine next. Hi, Mary.
Oh, hello. Hi, good morning.
Good morning.
Thank you for your show. It's very interesting. I have a question. If a person has only a Social Security income and lives in her own home and she is 81, she ought to still file taxes or is excluded?
Okay.
I didn't catch
that. All right. So we have an 81-year-old who is living on Social Security only, wondering if that person would have to file an income tax form.
If Social Security is the only income that she has, it will not be taxable.
Okay. She owns her own home. She's still in her own home. Would that be any issue or not?
That's not an issue on the negative side. For the state of Wisconsin, if she's in her own home, and depending on how much her Social Security is, she might qualify for a homestead credit, which would help her pay the property taxes on her own home. But that will depend on how large her Social Security is, because...
And the Social Security is $1,400-some.
Based on that, the number for homestead credit is around $24,000. Your income cannot exceed $24,000. So based on the $1,400 a month, it's possible that she could qualify for a Wisconsin homestead credit. So I would recommend that she check into that.
Okay, thank you so much for your advice, and have a great day.
Yeah, you as well.
Also.
Thank you very much for calling. Appreciate your call. Let's go to Don in Sheboygan next. Hi, Don. Thank you for calling.
Sure.
What can we do for you?
My question comes from, I'm 76 years old, and I started investing in all these 401ks and everything when they first started out 40-some years ago. And back then, when you started into these things, the government had all kinds of rules and regulations and all kinds of forms that you had to keep. It was like the 8606 and your tax forms and all that. And I take my minimum distributions and all that stuff now, but what do I do with these forms? I call the IRS, and it's like they didn't know what I was talking about.
Okay.
Let me ask
a couple questions, first of all. Are your 401ks still in 401ks, or have they been rolled into IRAs?
They've all been rolled into IRAs and things like that.
So the 8606 form that you're talking about is a form that says that you had some after-tax contributions into that IRA.
Basically, right.
Right. Except if you're talking about the older IRAs, years ago you were able to put in tax the older 401ks, you were able to put in tax, after-tax dollars as well as the pre-tax dollars.
Correct.
In the older days, you had to take out your after-tax dollars before you rolled it into your IRA. So if you have an 8606 that's part of your package, it would imply that you put some after-tax dollars into the IRAs. And if that's the case, there's a formula using the 8606 that will not make you pay taxes on, in a proportional way on the dollars that you take out of it due to money that you've already paid taxes on. So
okay,
if,
but what do I do with all these forms and stuff now? When I went to my, because I have everything under one, I put everything under one company now, and they didn't seem to know what you do with all these forms and stuff.
Well, if they're, if they are the 8606 form that you mean, your basis, your after-tax cost basis in those IRAs carries forward every year, and each year you should be including that 8606 in your tax return so that you're telling the government what my after-tax basis is and how much I used of it each year as I report minimum required distributions.
Right, but the problem is nobody seems to know what nobody seems to know what to do with these forms. Even when I call the IRS, they
professional, if it's an 8606 form, a tax professional should know what to do with it. I don't know about the IRS person that you talked to, but
right.
It is the 8606 is an IRS form, so they really should know what it's about.
Yeah.
Then when I started taking my distributions out, and this company said, well, we have everything on computer, don't worry about it, and they just...
Do you notice that 8606 form in your tax packet?
Right, it's not. I mean,
yeah,
I don't use it for anything now.
Well, it's something that you should look into. If it really is a properly filled out 8606 and you're not using it as a part of your packet, you're paying more taxes than you need to.
Oh, that'd be worth looking at a tax professional to give some advice on, wouldn't it, Mary?
That's an excellent idea.
Yeah. I do that, Don. Thank you so much for calling. Appreciate your call. You can join in, too, by the way. The number to call is 1-800-642-1234. Email at talk@WPR.org or post on our Facebook page at The Larry Mealer Show. Bill posted on Facebook that at the Larry Mealer Show Facebook page about prizes, and see what you think of this, Mary. He says that you can refute the valued claimed by the provider of your prize and file 1099 miscellaneous using reasonable values for the services and products received. You must support or demonstrate your reasonable values.
And he's asking whether I agree with that or not.
Yeah.
I agree with that. Keep in mind that it has to be either an appraisal value of what you got or some kind of backup, which he does allude to. The only problem with that you have to be careful of when you're filing your tax return, the IRS will have the document that shows what that document is reporting. You have to adjust your tax return so that they recognize that you've reported it and in a way back it out to report the right one. So there's a little bit more to the reporting. If you just report a different number, you're going to get an IRS letter because they're going to match it, and then you'll have to produce that stuff at that point.
Yeah, so better to do it ahead of time for sure. All right, let's turn to Barbara in Appleton next. Hi, Barbara. Thanks for calling.
Hi, good morning. I have a quick question. My husband died this past year. What is the most important thing I should remember? I do have a financial advisor, but I just wondered if she had any comments or advice on what I should be aware of. And one of them is how long should, and the other question was, how long should I keep all these financial old papers tax papers and everything. I don't know how long to keep stuff, and my files are getting very bulky.
Okay, well, we're certainly sorry about the death of your husband. That the first year, the year in which he died, your tax return is going to look a lot like it did other years when he was alive. Because if you filed a joint return in the past, generally the year of death will be a joint return. You need to have all of the income that was earned by him up to the point that he died. And then from that time on, it'll be the income that you've earned. Now, that could mean retirement distributions. It could mean stock. For some people, it's W-2s. It is the next year when you are filing single that you'll notice a change. As far as the old tax returns that you have, I recommend that you keep them at least 10 years. Now, things, if you have investments, Wisconsin is a marital property state, and as such, generally your investments that you had together become yours, you know, depending on how you have your estate set up between you and your husband. But most of things like stock and property owned will get a stepped-up basis. So in essence, you will be starting fresh with new numbers. That doesn't apply to annuities and retirement plans or IRAs, but it does to stocks and property. So I would assume that you are either working with an attorney or a financial planner that is knowledgeable in this area, and they will have those numbers or help you get those numbers so that you go forward on the right note.
What are the what is it I'm looking for in this last thing, that when I'm single,
you'll be filing as a single.
What does that mean, stepped up?
If, for instance, if you and your husband owned a home, and
right,
let's say you bought it 30 years ago for $75,000, and that home is worth $200,000 today, starting going forward, if you were to sell the house in the future, that house would not have the $75,000 basis that you actually paid for it, but rather it would have a $200,000 basis in my example.
So that's good for you.
And that's to my advantage.
It is to your advantage, yes. But having those numbers, because those new numbers are determined as its fair market value when your husband died. So I assume that you have worked with an attorney or a financial planner or someone who helped you come up with those numbers based on what's in your portfolio or your estate.
But the numbers change next year when I'm single.
No, the numbers change as of the date of your husband's death. But if you don't sell any of that property till in the future, you won't need those numbers until going forward.
Okay. I think I got it. Right,
You can still, Maria, this is true that she would still be, Barbara would still claim her husband as an
In the year of death, they would file a joint return if they have filed a joint return in the past, where he would be listed in the same way and there would be two exemptions on that return.
Got it. Okay. Thank you.
All right. Thank you very much for calling, Barbara. Appreciate it. And let's go next to Roberta in Willard. Roberta, thank you for calling.
Well, thank you for taking my call.
What can we do for you?
Well, I have a very simple question for you, and that is that if one is not earning quite enough money to be required to pay a tax, do they have to send in forms?
I'm assuming a single person?
Yes.
Okay. If the single person is under the filing requirement, which I mentioned, the $10,350, unless, of course, there's other adjustments for blind or age. But if you're under that, there is no need, there's no requirement to file a tax return.
Well, thank you very much. That's what I wanted to know.
Yeah.
Okay.
Thank you for calling. Let's go to Bart in Fort Atkinson. Hi, Bart.
Hi, Larry. This is Bart. I just have one question. On people, I guess they don't have inheritance tax anymore, but when you did pay it, is there any credit you can get back on that or anything like that?
I'm not sure what you're asking. There is still an inheritance tax, not in the state of Wisconsin, but there's a federal inheritance tax if your estate is over about $5.2 million.
What I'm saying is if you paid it in the past, and they changed the law,
are you credited?
Is there any credit you get back?
Credit for inheritance?
Inheritance tax that you already paid?
Yeah.
No. Not in that it would have been taken. Wisconsin would give a credit for the inheritance tax paid and the federal. The only time that there might be something is if you're paying double tax in the sense that there was inheritance tax paid on something that also shows up as income tax on your tax return. For instance, a retirement plan, if you inherited an IRA from someone who died who had to pay inheritance tax, there would be an effect on your personal return as a deduction. But that's the only way that I can think of.
Okay. All right. There we go. Thanks a lot for calling. Appreciate your call, Bart. Christine in Milwaukee, we're on to you now. Hi, Christine.
Hey, Mary, Larry. My question is about annual reports. I'm a income property owner here in Milwaukee. I own three duplexes, and I applied for an LLC about 2 years ago. Haven't done anything with it. It just seems to sit there after I paid my original, whatever, $160. I just received this glaring yellow postcard in the mail that says, you are delinquent in your annual report. And I don't know anything about annual reports or that I even needed to do one.
In order to keep an LLC alive, there is a fee that you pay on an annual basis. I believe it's $50. It's either $25 or $50 that you pay each year to keep the right to have that LLC.
I see.
Now, when you started the LLC, did you mean for the properties to be in that LLC?
That was the original idea, but I never actually changed anything.
Okay. If you didn't change anything, the properties are not in the LLC, and the LLC isn't doing you any good. So unless you want it to, you may want to dissolve or get rid of your LLC.
Thank you. Okay.
All right. Thanks very much for calling. Appreciate your call. Barry Mellum of Ashwaubenon Tax Professionals of Green Bay, our guest here. I'm Larry Mueller on the Ideas Network. Thanks for joining us today on the Ideas Network. Larry Mueller here with my guest, Mary Mellum, tax professional from Green Bay, Wisconsin. She and her husband, David, operate Ashwaubenon Tax Professionals. And I believe we have a link on our Facebook page to their business. Great to have her with us. She comes by monthly during tax season to talk with you and with me about our taxes. And join in with your own tax question at 1-800-642-1234. Email us at talk@wpr.org or post on our Facebook page, The Larry Mueller Show. Bob in Sheboygan has a question for you, Mary. Hi, Bob. Thank you for calling.
Good morning, Larry. Thank you very much for having me. Once in a while, I'm from Sheboygan. Once in a while, I'm from Cribbets at my cabin. Okay, I have a question here. We take care of my mother-in-law, who is 91 years of age. Okay, and right now she's not in really terrific physical condition. Okay, she's been with us 9 years. Okay, if she would, and I claim her as a dependent for all these 9 years. Okay, if she would pass away, and God willing, it doesn't happen, but say this month, do I claim her for a dependent for the whole year or do I not?
Yes. As far as dependent, a dependent need only be alive for 1 minute in a year to be your dependent for the entire year.
Okay, so I would pick up the whole year.
Yep.
Correct. No adjustment.
Okay, thank you so much. Yep.
Thanks a lot for calling. Appreciate your call, Bob. Doug emailed to say his tax preparer charged him $75 to tell the IRS he paid tax on a small pension. The letter told them to look on line 16B. Is that $75 fully tax deductible?
If he is, well, tax preparation and tax counseling is an itemized deduction. You have to itemize and use a Schedule A, and it is a miscellaneous itemized deduction. But yes, the cost is a deduction, and whether it benefits you depends on your tax situation.
Yep, there we go. Let's turn to Carrie in Black Earth. Hi, thanks for calling.
Hi, Larry. Hi, Mary.
Hi.
My question is, and it may be silly, I've never asked anyone this question before, but I am married for 2 years, and we have a child. And my student loans repayment plan is way more than I can afford because they're doing an income-based based on our filing together last year. Is there a way to file separately from my husband so that I can do an income-based repayment on my income versus our joint income?
Yes, there is a way to file separately, and I believe that if you do file separately that they would base it on your income. I'm not totally knowledgeable on, you know, the payback of loans. But
sure.
The way that you
would be beneficial to file separately.
Here's the deal. I assume you live, Black Earth, in Wisconsin.
Mm-hmm.
So you're a Wisconsin resident.
Mm-hmm.
In the state of Wisconsin, we're a marital property law, a marital property state, which means that when you file your tax return, you would include all of the one half of the joint income, unless you had a premarital agreement. Now, that's how you would file your tax returns. So basically, you'd be listing your income, and you would have added yours and your husband's income together and divided in two, and each one of you would be including that much money on your tax return. Now, that's how you would file for tax purposes. If the loan allows you to base it just on your income and not make that marital adjustment for their purposes, that may help you. But that's a question you need to ask them, that what do I do in a marital property or community property state when the law requires me to include part of my husband's income?
Okay.
All right.
I appreciate it. Thank you.
Yeah, thanks a lot for calling. Appreciate your call. Melissa in Wauwatosa, we're on to you now. Hi, Melissa. Melissa, are you there?
Hi there. I'm here. Can you hear me?
Yes.
Hi. Thank you for taking my question.
Sure.
I work remotely full-time from a virtual office out of my home, and I'm wondering if you can tell me more about the home office deduction in Wisconsin. What I need to know, or, you know, any tips or strategies for claiming this and maximizing the deduction for a home office?
Okay. My first question to you is, if you are working remotely, is it your choice or is it your employer's requirement that you work remotely?
Both. So it is a 100% virtual office. So all staff work virtually from home offices.
Okay. So it's a requirement. You don't have an office space where you could go to if you chose to do it the other way?
No, I do not.
Okay. The reason I ask that makes a difference in whether you can have an office in home or not. Since you're required to do it, and I'm assuming you are an employee, you're not an independent contractor. Is that also correct?
That is, yes.
Okay. As an employee, in order to take all home office deduction, it has to be required by your employer. So you've met that situation. As far as a home office, are you reimbursed anything for having that office?
I am not, no.
Okay. Then your home office deduction is based on the square footage of your dedicated space. So in a home office, you have to have a space that is totally dedicated to the business and not usable for any other purpose. And what I mean by that is that if you happen to have a bedroom that you use, but you have your computer in your bedroom, that's not going to work out because it's not dedicated space.
Mm-hmm.
On the other hand, you could have a part of that bedroom that is not used for anything else, and it doesn't have to have walls around it. You know, you can have invisible walls, but it has to be a dedicated space. Now, assuming that you have that dedicated space, you're comparing the square footage of that dedicated space to the entire square footage of the livable part of the house. For most people, you know, if you have a ranch home and the basement is minimally finished, it's the first floor that you're comparing. That percentage, the square footage of the dedicated space to the square footage of the home, gives you the percentage of things that you're going to be able to take. Now, you have utilities and property tax and mortgage interest and any other repairs or things like that that affect the whole house. You would get a percentage of those.
So if it was 10 square feet, let's say, or just for example, or 10% of the house, then you'd get to take 10% of the taxes and so forth.
That's correct. There is also a shortened version of it that allows you, there's a formula, and it's, I believe the maximum is 500 square feet, or 500 square foot. It's so much, $5 up to maybe 300. I believe it's a maximum of 1500. But that one doesn't require you to itemize all of the expenses, but rather take the shortened version if you qualify. So you might want to take a look at that. What is important is that it is a Schedule A miscellaneous 2% deduction. So you first have to itemize, and secondly, the miscellaneous deductions that you have to be over 2% of your adjusted gross income in order for you to get any benefit. And the last thing is, on the Wisconsin return, there is no benefit for it because Wisconsin does not allow miscellaneous itemized deductions in their calculation of their credit.
There you go. You got that, Melissa?
Great, I do. Thank you so much.
Yep. Thanks very much for calling. Christine in Stevens Point has a question for us. Let's go there. Hi, Christine.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. I'm calling about my mother, who she's 99, and for the past, I think at least 10 years, she hasn't had to pay any kind of taxes. But this year she started getting veteran benefits. Is that taxable?
The veterans benefits most often are benefits based on disability or things like that. In most cases, I don't believe those kinds of veterans benefits would be taxable.
Okay. She's 99 and she's getting these benefits based on my father having been in the service. She should have applied for it before, but she didn't. So.
And I believe that those kind are not, but your telltale sign will be in when veterans get retirement payments, they will get a 1099-R with those benefits. If in a reasonable period during the year you do not receive that, that means that she's getting the non-taxable form of benefits.
Okay. And then while I was waiting online, there was one other question that came to mind. My siblings and I are helping her each, or will be helping her each, about maybe $100+ a month. There's no tax benefits for dependents unless you say you have to give at least half of it, am I right, of her living expenses?
Yes. You have to support more. In order for any dependent to be your dependent, you have to pay more than 50% of the cost of supporting her. Now, if multiple people do it, then there is an arrangement that if these multiple people contribute at least 10% of that cost, you can make a decision by filing the right form for 1 year one person to take her and one person and another year to do it. It's called a multiple support agreement.
Okay.
That you might want to look into depending on how it is.
Okay.
All right.
It's been great. Thanks for answering my question.
Yeah. Thanks very much for calling.
Bye-bye.
And you can join in too at 1-800-642-1234. Tom in River Falls has a question. Hi, Tom.
Hi. Yeah, Mary, I had a question regarding my daughter. She graduated from college this year in May, and she's working, and she'll be filing her first return on her own. My question is, on our 529 distribution that we have this year, does she put it on her return or our return? Since we are the owner and she was the beneficiary?
It depends on who's going to get the 1099. There's a 1099-Q that comes out, and it depends on who's viewed as having taken the money out. Sometimes they come in the parent's name. Sometimes they come in the child's name. Whoever is seen as having taken that money out has to reconcile what it was paid for and determine if there's any taxable event.
Okay, so yeah, we're considered the owner, and she was considered the beneficiary of that. That's what it says on the account.
That's what it says on the account. But look to that 1099-Q, because in that situation you described, it will depend on who is seen as taking it out.
Okay.
And it depends, I believe. I think that there's some kind of criteria. If it goes directly to the school, I believe it's the child that gets the 1099. If it's taken out to reimburse costs that have been paid, it's generally whoever took the money out. Okay. So just look for that 1099-Q, and that's the person that will have to reconcile it.
There we go. Thank you so much for that question, Tom. Mary Mellum is going to be with us right up till about 12:30 today. We're going to take a quick look at the news, weather, find out what else is in store for us, and then we'll be back. You stay with us. Well, tax day is what, 3 months away? About 3 months away, almost to the day. That may be raising your blood pressure. Maybe not. Larry Mueller here. Great to have you along today on the Ideas Network as we visit with Mary Mellum, tax professional from Green Bay, Wisconsin. Been in the tax business a long time. She and her husband, David, operate Ashwabanan Tax Professionals and consult with individuals and businesses and also teach seminars. And Mary, thanks again for spending time with us today.
You're welcome.
We have callers online. There's one for you, open for you at 1-800-642-1234. Let's turn to Carol in Dubuque, Iowa next. Carol, hello. Thank you for calling.
Hi, Larry. Great show. I have a question for Mary. My husband recently had to go into a nursing retirement home the middle of November, and I'm wondering if any of what we're doing private pay, if any of that is deductible or can be claimed as part of a medical expense or anything.
Okay.
The answer to that is he in there under a doctor's requirement, a doctor's suggestion? It's not just for convenience.
No, the doctor did suggest it.
Okay. I mean, is he incapable of self-care? If he is, there are five tests of daily living, and if you are unable to do at least two of these five, it's like eating, toileting, transferring, bathing, and dressing, I believe, are the five. But if you cannot yourself do at least two of those, generally when you're staying in a nursing facility under those circumstances, those expenses, the entire expenses of the nursing home, would be a deductible medical expense.
If he can do two of them, then
if he cannot do at least two of those daily living functions himself, then that's what we call someone who is chronically ill, and they qualify, even if you don't have a doctor telling you specifically that you have to be in the nursing home.
Okay. All right. And how do I find out what those five are?
They would be eating, toileting, bathing, dressing, and transferring.
Okay. And he needs to be able to do two of them.
No, he needs to be able not to do at least two.
Not to be able to do two.
So
okay.
if he is in a wheelchair and can't get into bed himself, that would be the transferring type thing.
Right.
If he's not able to
Make his own dinner.
Feed himself. That would be another one, you know, depending on the situation. You could always ask your doctor to write a letter saying, you know, for your own benefit, saying that he needs to be in a nursing facility or he needs care beyond which, you know, he can get by himself.
Yeah.
And that allows you to have everything. Otherwise, if, for instance, you're in a someone's in an assisted living, it's only the medical care that's provided as far as that goes. So if you're in a nursing facility, it's the cost of the food, the facility, the medical care. If you're in an assisted living and don't meet at least two of those, fail two of those tests, then it's only the medical care that's provided.
I see. Okay, then.
All right. Thank you very much for calling. Appreciate your call, Carol. And kind of along with that, Nancy emailed to ask if her high health care premiums are deductible.
Health care premiums are deductible if they're paid by you. If they're paid by your employer, they're not a deductible expense because you've never used your money for it. So it depends on how they're paid.
On to Rebecca in Iron Ridge next. Hi, Rebecca.
Hello. Thank you for taking my call, Larry.
Sure thing. What's on your mind?
Well, I'm 66. My husband is 75. I had a couple thousand dollars in a regular IRA in a bank, and I wanted to change. I did change those over to a Roth IRA, and I was wondering how much I'm going to be taxed, if there's any kind of a special tax situation with that, if you're over 66. And
nope. If you convert an IRA, a traditional IRA into a Roth,
right,
you will get a statement that shows like a distribution. And so whatever that dollar amount is will be taxable to you now.
At whatever rate I'm taxed at. Okay.
That's correct.
Okay. Can I ask another question quick?
Sure.
My mother passed away this year, and I believe from a previous caller, it sounds like someone has to do her taxes for this whole year, even though she passed away in October.
She died in October of 2016.
Yes.
If she has enough income that requires her to file, someone is responsible, the personal representative is responsible to see that that tax return is filed.
Okay.
If, for instance, she's living on Social Security or her income comes under the filing requirement, technically you're not required to file it.
Okay. I think probably they'll have to file. The other question I was wondering is if I inherit anything, which I'm not sure, would I be fully taxed on that?
Depends on what you inherited. If she had money in a bank account and you inherit a bank account, the money in it, it's not taxable. If she had money in an IRA account and you receive the money from the IRA account, somebody, either you or the estate, will pay taxes on that money.
So if it's taken out, say it might be an IRA or a trust, if it's a trust?
If it's a trust, if money goes into a trust, then the money, if it was a trust she set up upon death or became irrevocable upon death, it's only the income that the trust earns after she dies that's taxable. But again, if it comes from retirement accounts that were not taxed before she died, that's where you end up having some income from
So if she had like stock or something and that's sold and that's cashed out it might be done this year, I don't know.
Chances are the stock is not going to cause the problem.
Okay.
There may be dividends earned after she died that could be part of your earnings. But the stock, as I mentioned before, is one of the things that gets what we call a stepped-up basis. It's revalued at her date of death.
Okay.
And if it is and sold relatively close, there's usually not a gain to pay taxes on. It's the retirement accounts and the annuities that cause inheritance to be taxable most often.
Okay, so then if her estate pays the tax, then I don't have to pay it again also for anything I get?
If the estate pays the tax because it comes in a year that the money wasn't distributed to you, then the estate will pay taxes. But it's coming out of the estate, which means it's coming out of what you ultimately will receive. And the estate pays a higher rate of tax than the individual does. If to the extent that you received any distributions in that year, that income will be taxable to you if it was estate income.
Okay, I won't get anything until this year. So I don't think anything's been done yet.
Right, and it depends. There can be a fiscal year, so it could all be done in 1 year. You just, whatever comes through. Just expect if she had IRAs or if she had annuities, that you probably will pay something.
There we go.
Okay, I thank you very much.
Thanks a lot for calling. Appreciate your call. And Jim in Elk Mound would like to know if, Mary, if you know what per diem is for truck drivers this year.
The truck driver's per diem is $63 a day. It's the same as it was in 2015.
Okay. All right, let's go to Dan in La Crosse then. Dan, hello.
Hey, good afternoon, Larry. Really enjoy your show.
Thank you.
Try to listen to it whenever I can. And thanks, Mary. Got a question. I'm a Minnesota resident, and I've just recently been granted temporary custody of three minor children. It's a long story, and the custody is likely to go beyond the school year. At some point, I believe we're going to be receiving some money from social services. So I'm curious as if I have to file this money that I receive as income and then claim the children as dependents, or if I need to take a different approach.
Were these children placed with you by an agency?
By the social services, yes.
Okay. And so if they're placed with you, and I'm assuming they're under the age of 19?
Yeah, they're 4, 5, and 12.
Okay. And have you had them for more than half of the year?
Well, no, but we will.
Okay.
I guess I'm asking the question for next year.
In the future. If they're with you for more than half of the year and they're placed by an agency, then you have a right to claim their deduction as long as they don't bring more than half of their support to the table. Generally, social services income is not a taxable event to you.
Okay.
All right.
And, you know, unless it's a large amount that constitutes their support and it would be looked on as what they brought to the table, it's not going to be taxable and it won't prevent you from claiming the children.
Okay. Well, very good. Well, that's been very helpful. Thank you for your time.
Thanks very much for calling. Appreciate your call.
Yes, thank you.
And let's turn to Sue in Watertown next. Sue, hello to you.
Hi. my question is, 8 years ago, I signed a quitclaim deed to my home in my daughter's name. Now I want to I want to sell the house. I need to get out of here. 5 acres is too much. So my question is she going to have to pay capital gains because this is not her primary residence?
It's very possible. With the quitclaim deed, did you retain the right to live in that property?
Yes.
Okay. If you retain the right to live in that property, then it's a joint sale. It's part her sale and part your sale.
Okay.
There is a formula there's a formula that will say that depending on your age and depending on the interest rate that was effective back in 8 years ago when you did this, there will be a percentage of the sale that is yours and you report and you will not pay taxes on it if you because this home is your principal residence. But because her percentage is not her principal residence, she will pay taxes on that. And she will need to know what your cost basis in the property was, you know, how much you paid for it with the improvements, and she'll get a percentage of that to go against the percentage of the sale proceeds.
Okay, and then if the house sells for exactly what I paid for it,
there would not be any capital gains, would there?
If the house sold for exactly what you paid for it, then she probably would have no capital gain.
Okay, that helps very much. Thank you so much. And Larry, I enjoy this show and your garden talk.
Well, thank you so much,
okay,
Sue.
Bye-bye.
Appreciate the call. And we had Doug and Randolph switch to three different companies to manage his retirement funds in his life. So over time, he invested in three different ones. The 401k and 403b got mixed together somehow. He's 62 now. Does it make any difference how he draws it out?
What it sounds like, if they got mixed together, chances are it's been rolled into an IRA. And it becomes the IRA, not the 401k, and the IRA rules on distributions would apply. So the IRAs could all be treated as one, and he has to take out whatever his amount is based on his age and the amount balance at the end of the prior year.
All right. There we go. Let's turn to Bob in Sheboygan next. Bob, hello. Thank you for calling.
Good morning. I hate to bother you again. Okay, I got one other question with this. Again, my mother-in-law is 91. She's been with us 9 years. And naturally, we don't charge her anything. We take care of her. We claim her as a dependent. Okay, if she would have to go to a nursing home, you know, because it's not, you know, she's not doing very well physically. Okay, she has a checking account set up, a checking account/savings account set up, and it's my wife's name on there as well as my mother-in-law's name. Okay, does that have to be exhausted before I go through the state for this or not?
As far as I think what you're asking about is Medicaid.
Yes.
And for her to be on Medicaid, there is a certain dollar amount of assets that she's able to have. And
okay,
if she has over that amount, it has to be exhausted before she would qualify for it.
Okay, where is that cutoff point? Do you have any idea?
No. I don't. I would check with Social Services or Medicaid in your county.
Sure. Okay, thank you very much.
You're welcome.
Thanks a lot for calling. Appreciate your call. And you can join in at 1-800-642-1234. We'd certainly love to hear from you. Got a couple minutes left in the program, and certainly love to hear from you. Advantages of itemizing deductions rather than the standard deduction, I guess it all comes down to number of dollars that you've got to itemize, doesn't it?
Right. As a married couple, if your itemized deductions that you're able to deduct after the 10% medical or after the 2% AGI for miscellaneous, if they exceed $12,600, it's to your advantage to itemize.
Gary in Mason has something for us. Hi, Gary. Thanks for calling.
Very interesting program, and I'm sorry I had to leave during part of it, so you may have covered some of this. One of my questions for Mary, and this is a real good program, and I'm thankful that you're hosting and that Mary's participating in it.
Thank you.
In regards to my mother, who is in actually went from a private apartment in 1 year, and at the end of that year, she went to nursing home placement, and she was self-pay up until her death. I was wondering what the length of time is permitted to file rent credit is.
The homestead credit, is that what you're talking about?
The homestead credit?
Well, her rent changed from being in a private home to a nursing home.
Okay.
But
the question I'm asking is, there is a rent credit that is part of the Wisconsin tax return that you can get up to a $300 deduction against your taxes or credit against your taxes. That's one thing. But a homestead credit is another thing that is based on income of no more than $24,000, roughly. And if that's what you're talking about, the homestead credit, you must be alive when you qualify for that credit.
Okay.
There is a three-year amendment that you can get. You can go back 3 years. But if you're not alive when that is done, you don't qualify for it.
Okay. Well, she...
Has she filed income taxes in the past?
She has, but I took over as her executor, and she hadn't filed in the recent past.
Homestead credit that you're talking about.
Right.
And because she's not alive at the time you want to file it, she would not be getting it.
Okay.
All right. Thanks very much for calling. And Jeannie in Eau Claire, your turn. Hi, Jeannie.
Hi, good afternoon. Thank you for taking my call. My cousin Pat has been taking care of her husband in her home, and the cares are such that she does total cares on him. He's unable to feed himself or toilet himself or anything. And so she's had to hire private caregivers to come in and assist her. Would the cost of those caregivers be tax deductible?
Yes. As long as those people, the predominant reason that they're there is to provide medical care, eating, toileting, you know, that kind of thing is all part of that. If she hired them to clean her house, it would have to be insignificant compared to the medical care that they were providing. And the other thing is they do not have to be nurses like LPNs or registered nurses.
Okay.
They can be anyone who performs these medical things.
Okay,
yes,
great.
It would be a part of her itemized deductions.
Great, thank you.
Thank you for calling. And John in La Crosse, thanks for calling. What's on your mind?
In 2016, I received a sum of money from my dad, and it's over $14,000 in my tax. Do I have to pay taxes on that money?
Okay, first of all, the sum of money that you got from your dad, was it a gift?
Well, he's in failing health. It's either a gift or probably a pre-inheritance.
Okay. If it is a gift of $14,000 or more than $14,000, your dad is responsible to file a gift tax return of Form 709. There won't be any tax on it unless he gave more than $5 million in his lifetime.
Okay.
But it still needs to be, the form needs to be filed if there was a gift to you of more than $14,000. And it's on him that it is, not on you.
Okay.
All right. Thanks. Thanks very much for calling. Appreciate your call. Mary, in the last 30 seconds, any final tips for us?
Two things I wanted to mention. If any of the listeners are claiming earned income credit this year, there has been notice out, but the earned income credit refunds will not go out until at least February 15th before the IRS starts looking at them, and probably the end of the month before people will be getting their earned income credit. The second thing is that the Affordable Care Act is still alive and well for 2016. So if you still need to answer the question, do you have health insurance? And if you don't, there's the penalty. The penalty this year for not having health insurance is the greater of $695 or 2.5% of your household income, which is really AGI.
And on that note, we have to close. Mary, thank you so much. Look forward to your next visit.
All right.
Mary Mellum, tax professional with Ashwaubenon Tax Professionals of Green Bay. And thank you for listening.